Oak Beach is a small, gated community that exists as its own little oasis. It's just a speck along the Ocean Parkway, a thin, stretched-out four-lane highway that travels along the southern expanse of New York's Long Island. For many, this is a vacation getaway no different from many others. New Yorkers often flee to Long Island in the summer to take a break from their fast-paced, busy lives. But for a few, Oak Beach is home. Gus Coletti lives here in Oak Beach, and he has for over 30 years. Gus is a former insurance fraud investigator, a man who made a living by locating inconsistencies, no matter how small or big. But now, at 75 years of age, Gus is retired and enjoying his retirement with a comfortable home here in Oak Beach. Gus is long married, and now he busies himself with hobbies these days, mainly taking care of the 35 pigeons he houses on his property. He also has a few parrots. This morning, Gus is up pretty early. He has a car show to see in Rhinebeck, a nearly 3-hour drive away. It's somewhere between 4 and 5 a.m. when Gus, who is in the bathroom shaving, hears the first sounds of trouble. He hears the sound of someone's fist banging against his front door. This would alarm anyone at any time of the day or night, but at this early in the morning, it could be nothing good. Alarmed and slightly panicked, Gus approaches his front door with trepidation. He undoubtedly peers through a window to see who stands on the other side of the door. It's a young woman, short and thin, wearing a light-colored tank top. Gus Coletti lets the woman inside, and she immediately begins to plead with him. Help me," she demands, her own voice replacing his panic with fear. Gus urgently wants to help this young woman, who can't be a day over 25 years old, so he guides her to a nearby chair and calls 911 from his landline telephone. "They're going to kill me," she screams. As Gus urges this young woman to tell him what's wrong, she just stares at him. Her panicked pleas cease, and she bolts for the still open door when he tells her that he's calling for emergency services. While the phone dials, Gus is now helpless. Within a moment, this alarmed young woman has entered his life, demanding help, and is now running away from it, as if she was being chased. Gus Coletti finishes his call to 911, informing them of what's happened. It is then that he steps outside, onto a second-story porch that the young woman just descended. He sees a black SUV traveling down the road, stopping and going slowly, as if it was searching for someone. This is when Gus sees the young woman again. Now she is ducked under his boat, hiding from the SUV in a crouched position in his driveway. The black SUV is coming closer, obviously searching for the young woman, and as it does, Gus gets a closer look at the person behind the wheel. It's an Asian male who is scanning the neighborhood. The driver of the SUV slows as he approaches Gus Coletti's house, and asks out an open window if he's seen a young woman who left a house party. Gus tells the man that he called 911, and the driver's response sends chills down his spine. "You shouldn't have done that," he says. "She's going to get in a lot of trouble." The young woman runs off into the dark, down the gated neighborhood called the Fairway. She passes by houses that have their lights off, and heads towards the dark intersection of Sandy Drive. Barbara Brennan lives here, and the front of her house is known for a lighted vigil she has kept for about a decade now, in remembrance for her husband, lost in the September 11th attacks. The young woman begins pounding on Barbara's door, but isn't greeted by any response. Barbara places two phone calls, one to the police at approximately 5:22 a.m., and an immediate follow-up to her neighbor, Tom Canning. Tom Canning, a retired landscaper, gets dressed and heads over to Barbara's house immediately with his dog, a large hunting breed. But by that time, the young woman is gone. She would never be seen alive again, but her dramatic actions that night would begin to peel back the layers of a mystery decades in the making. A decade that has since gone on to define the area of Gilgo Beach. Welcome to the Unresolved Podcast. I'm your host, Michael Whelan, and this story is one for the ages. A modern-age Jack the Ripper tale that has left the entire Long Island area in shock. Now, let's dive right into it. This is the story of how the Long Island serial killer was discovered. Thank you. Oak Beach, the setting of the story in the introduction, is just a section of the area known as Gilgo Beach. Connected to Jones Beach, the area makes up one of the long, thin islands on the southern tip of Long Island. Oak Beach is just the area closest to Oak Island, one of the many specks of land between Gilgo Beach and Long Island itself. As I said, it's primarily a vacation spot for New Yorkers and other East Coasters during the summer. There are permanent residences, but by and large, it's an area that doesn't see a lot of traffic in the colder months of the year. The area is known for its beautiful-looking beaches, but also for its haunted landscapes that truly come alive at night. The brambled bushes that cover the island give it a definitive look during the day, but hold unspeakable terrors during the night. Terrors both imaginative and real. I really encourage you to look up pictures of the Gilgo Beach brush, if you haven't seen it already, just to get a picture in your mind of this unusual environment. It's a landscape that is equal parts dream and nightmare. This entire strip of land is referred to as Jones Beach Island, which is itself technically a part of the town of Babylon, New York. The land is leased to the residences there by the town of Babylon, and is accessible by the Ocean Parkway, that four-lane road that runs throughout. This strip of land is part of Suffolk County, but is just as close as you can get to the outskirts as possible. It is due to it being so far out from the rest of Suffolk County that on the night in question, May 1st, 2010, it took police nearly an hour to get to Oak Beach. And they weren't just responding to Gus Coletti or Barbara Brennan's 911 phone calls. Many more neighbors had been awoken by the screaming woman outside their house, who was pounding on doors and pleading for someone to help her.
All of a sudden, I hear some banging on my door and somebody yelling, "Help me, help me, help me." So I came over and I opened the door and this young girl stepped in right away. And she just kept saying was, "Help me, help me, help me." And she was a little unstable on her feet.
Gus Coletti, that retiree that had been up early for a car show, waited at the community gatehouse for over 45 minutes until the police showed up. But by then, the young woman, known as Shannon Gilbert, had disappeared forever. Shannon Maria Gilbert was born on October 24th, 1986, in Ellenville, New York. She was the oldest of four sisters and had a, for lack of a better term, tumultuous relationship with her mother, Mary Gilbert. Shannon suffered some childhood abuse, both physical and emotional, and spent a fair amount of time in the foster care system from the age of seven. As a teenager, Shannon began to dabble in drugs and alcohol, but maintained a pretty great grade point average. She had dreams of fame and fashion, and becoming a singer-songwriter while also pursuing a career of being a writer. Her brains helped her graduate from New Paltz Central High School a year ahead of schedule, but the early graduation just gave Shannon a surge of independence. Immediately following her high school graduation, Shannon dyed her trademark brown hair blonde, and in the next year or two, drastically changed her life. For a time, she worked regular day jobs, including being a snack prepper for a senior center, a hostess for Applebee's, and a front desk manager at a hotel. But it wasn't enough for Shannon, who was dreaming bigger. She moved away from New York to New Jersey, and began to work for Lace Party Girls, a prostitution ring. In 2007, Shannon fell into some trouble. She was nabbed as part of a sting against Lace Party Girls, and had to suffer through some legal woes. She was also arrested again at some point for soliciting as a prostitute. But through Lace Party Girls, she met Alex Diaz, who would become her boyfriend. Diaz was a driver for the company, and the two began to date. Their relationship was good for a time, and money was becoming effortless for the two of them. Both Diaz and Shannon's family recount how generous she was with her earnings, giving them money when needed and buying them lavish gifts of clothing, gadgets, and jewelry. But when Lace Party Girls was shut down, the cash flow was cut off. Things began to get rocky between Shannon and Alex Diaz, especially after Shannon had a couple of abortions to prevent unwanted pregnancies. And her occasional drug use had already transitioned to being a regular thing. She had started doing drugs like cocaine and ecstasy with clients, but both of those joined alcohol into her normal repertoire and was beginning to become a problem. Shannon moved in with Diaz to his father's home in Jersey City, and Shannon began looking for other agencies. Shannon moved in with Diaz to his father's home in Jersey City, and Shannon began looking to other agencies for work. Things continued to deteriorate between the two, and fights were becoming much more common. Alex Diaz recalls one fight that became physical. When Shannon returned home one night, intoxicated, a fight broke out, which ended with Diaz punching Shannon in the jaw. The hit required surgery on Shannon, and she needed to get a metal part inserted to help repair her fractured jaw. It is also worth noting at this point that in her early adulthood, Shannon had been diagnosed with bipolar disorder. It is unknown whether her bipolar disorder was untreated or she was taking medication to help remedy it. And the fact that she was a frequent drug user does nothing to help cure that mental disorder, but may have worked in conjecture to explain some of her more dramatic mood swings. By 2010, Shannon had begun working independently. She wasn't working for a prostitution agency anymore, but was booking her own appointments through websites like Backpage and Craigslist. She worked with a driver, now known as Michael Pack, who would drive her to appointments and help provide a level of security. Shannon and Michael had met at her last agency, where he had also worked as a driver, and the two decided that they would make more money without the middlemen of the agency itself. Shannon had dreams of moving on from prostitution in the very near future. She had begun taking online college courses in communications, and had even started going to singing auditions in Manhattan. She was trying to make her dreams come true. On April 30th, 2010, Shannon and Alex Diaz went to a scary movie. They recall it being the Nightmare on Elm Street reboot. They had snuck in Taco Bell food to the theater, Diaz recalled, but she was going to be working that night. Hours later, she would leave their apartment, where they had just moved in months beforehand, with a noticeable thud at the door. And just like that, Alex Diaz would never see his girlfriend again. Michael Pack, Shannon's driver, had been working with her for just a few months. Michael Pack is somewhat of an anomaly in the story. He was a 41-year-old Asian-American from Queens, whose personal story is somewhat of a mystery. The only thing that's really known about him is that he used to enjoy posting videos of his cats on Facebook, and that he started working with Shannon sometime in 2009. They had been working together at one of the prostitution agencies, where Michael worked as a driver. To say that he was just a driver is a little bit of an understatement. These drivers, as they're called, essentially work as pimps for the women they transport. They act as security, they do drive, they fetch items while the women are with clients, but they also collect a cut of the money made that night. It's not far-fetched to say that they collect up to half of the total money earned, if not more. After going on the Taco Bell movie date with Alex Diaz, Shannon left with her driver, Michael. The two were taking the hour-and-a-half drive out to Oak Beach to meet up with a client. She normally didn't travel that far for clients, but sometimes the money was just too good to pass up. Joseph Brewer was a 47-year-old bachelor that lived alone in his house on Oak Beach. He was an out-of-work financial advisor that had recently separated from his wife, and apparently he had been enjoying himself a little bit too much ever since. Joseph Brewer was known to have a bit of an appetite for paid sex, at least according to one of his neighbors, who also said that his house had become a bit of a party pad since his wife had left. It wasn't unusual, then, that the SUV carrying Michael Pack and Shannon Gilbert arrived at around 2 o'clock that morning, in the wee hours of May 1st, 2010. While Shannon went inside to meet with the client, Michael Pack remained outside in the SUV. Phone records show 6 short calls made between Shannon and Michael, along with a call to a nearby CVS, located in West Islip, at around 2:55 a.m. Shannon wanted Michael to go pick up some lube and a deck of playing cards for her, but Michael said that he didn't know the area, so he wouldn't go. What happens over the next couple of hours is anyone's guess. But sometime that morning, something happened that would change the lives of all three individuals forever. Sometime between 4:30 and 5 o'clock a.m., Joseph Brewer tried to get Michael Pack's attention. Shannon Gilbert was still inside of his house, but he wanted her to leave. Or so he says. He had tried to grab Shannon from behind and force her out of his house, but had failed. So now he was summoning Michael, Shannon's driver, to come and do it for him. Shannon had taken cover behind one of Brewer's couches and had her cell phone in hand. She had already dialed 911 and started to tell them ominous words. "They're trying to kill me," she would say. Shannon's phone call to 911 was placed at 4:51 a.m. Right at that time, she ran out of Joseph Brewer's house, away from both the client and Michael Pack, claiming that they, either Brewer, Pack, or someone else, were trying to kill her. According to his statement, Brewer went upstairs in his house and had nothing to do with Shannon beyond that one incident. He would claim that the two of them never had sex, and that he hadn't even paid her for sex. In fact, he said that the reason for their sudden altercation, despite being in the same house for over 2 hours, was because he thought she was a man and didn't want to have sex with her. With Joseph Brewer presumably still in his house, Michael Pack hopped into his SUV to try and track down Shannon. In his mind, he thought that this was a trick on her part, to avoid paying him his cut, quote-unquote. So he was annoyed and probably a little angry when setting out to find her. I told you a good amount of the story in the introduction to the episode. Shannon knocked on doors, cried out for help, screamed that an unknown they were trying to kill her, and actually stayed on the line with her 911 call for over 23 minutes. Because of the odd jurisdiction of Oak Beach, being located so close to a state park, and technically belonging to a city 10 minutes away, her emergency call was forwarded to the state police. It also didn't help that she couldn't quite state where she was. She apparently told the dispatchers on the other end of the line that she was in Jones Beach, which was close but still miles away. Michael Pack claims that he was searching for her until 6 o'clock in the morning. In his words, from pitch black to sunny dawn, until at which point he left the area altogether, claiming to never see the police arrive. If he had stayed and spoken to police, Shannon might have been found that morning. Maybe she would have been found alive. Instead, Shannon Gilbert wasn't reported missing for nearly 2 days. Alex Diaz, Shannon's boyfriend, whom she shared a tumultuous relationship with, noticed something was up after Shannon hadn't returned home the day after her appointment with Joseph Brewer. The following day, he would get in touch with Michael Pack, Shannon's driver. Michael told Alex what had happened. Shannon meeting with the client, going nuts after a few hours, and then running off into the dark night in a drug-fueled craze. Alex took steps to get in touch with Joseph Brewer, the client. From there, Diaz tried to retrace Shannon's footsteps, even hesitantly traveling out to Oak Beach with a gun to meet with Brewer. Brewer was apparently as straightforward and honest as possible, both him and Diaz recall, and even went with Diaz to the police department to try and report Shannon missing. The officers at that Suffolk County police precinct basically just laughed at the entire situation. They told Diaz to go home, as that was the most likely place to find Shannon Gilbert. Then they said that if she wasn't home, to file a missing persons report there in Jersey City. So he did. But a day later, Shannon was still nowhere to be seen, and the police didn't seem very interested at all in trying to look for a missing prostitute. Alex Diaz decided to make another trip out to Oak Beach and met someone willing to help look for his lost girlfriend. This is where the story takes a very weird turn. 2 days after Shannon's disappearance, on May 3rd, her mother, Mary Gilbert, would receive a call from a stranger. "Hello," said the voice on the other end. It was the voice of an older male who gave his name freely. "My name is Dr. Peter Hackett. I'm calling to see if your daughter Shannon is there." Mary is immediately alerted to something. She's just not sure of what. "No, why? Who are you?" she asks. The voice on the other end, Dr. Peter Hackett, explains that he runs a house for wayward girls. He further explains that Shannon had been with him 2 days beforehand, right when she went missing, and that he had taken her in off of the street after she began knocking on his door. He would also claim that he had given her something, by that I mean a drug, to calm down and collect herself. Apparently, at that point, she went missing, leaving with her driver, in this case Michael Pack, and not returning. Mary asks how this stranger got her phone number, to which Hackett explains that all of the people that stay with him, at his alleged halfway house, have to give an emergency contact. This further confunds Mary, who knows that none of her family would give out her phone number to anyone. Also, she hasn't heard anything about Shannon going missing. Shannon's family would file a missing persons report for her in Jersey City, where she lived. They had found out about Shannon's meeting up with a client on Oak Beach through Alex Diaz, Shannon's boyfriend. But the police wouldn't make the connection between this missing persons report and the multiple 911 calls made on Oak Beach for over a month. Roughly a week later, on Mother's Day, May 9th, 2010, Mary Gilbert and the rest of Shannon's family would travel to Oak Beach to put up flyers and ask the neighborhood if they had seen anything. Dr. Peter Hackett would later detail this as the first time he had ever spoken to the Gilbert family. He immediately denied ever calling Mary Gilbert and claimed that he had never seen Shannon Gilbert before in his life. The Gilbert family reported this strange phone call to the New Jersey police squad that took their missing persons report. Unfortunately, this police squad was located miles away, where Shannon Gilbert actually lived. They were not in contact with anyone from Suffolk County, where Shannon had actually gone missing. Even with all of this unfolding out on Oak Beach, no one would come to look for Shannon for over a month. Dr. Peter Hackett was a former physician who had worked for Suffolk County as a police surgeon. He was married, with children of his own, and was, by my guess at this point in time, well into his 50s. When one looks at Dr. Hackett, they don't see a serial killer or a notorious liar. But beyond the surface, there's definitely something fishy going on with him. Hackett was known by many in Suffolk County to be a bit of a nuisance. Many claimed that he was a serial exaggerator, who liked to put his nose where it didn't belong. In 1996, TWA Flight 800 took off from JFK International Airport, headed for Rome, but exploded somewhere above New York. It was a pretty tragic incident. 230 passengers were killed aboard that flight, and many of their bodies were scattered throughout New York, particularly the Suffolk County area. Hackett embarrassed his co-workers by embellishing his role as an investigator in that incident, and from that point forward, had a figurative target placed on his back. Years later, he would be fired by Suffolk County for misusing a work cell phone and for claiming to be at work when he was actually absent. Over the years, rumors would circulate that he used his expertise as a doctor to illegally prescribe pharmaceuticals. Two of his neighbors would sign affidavits claiming to have been witness to him acting as a doctor out of his own kitchen, trying to mend injuries or prescribe some kind of medication to neighbors. Peter Hackett's place in the story, the disappearance of Shannon Gilbert, is entirely fascinating to me. He doesn't have a direct tie to either Shannon, Michael Pack, or his neighbor from down the street, Joseph Brewer. He claims to have never met any of them. He was married to his longtime wife, had a son and daughter living at home with him, and had both college and high school graduation trips in his very near future. However, no one can deny that Dr. Peter Hackett went out of his way to insert himself into the story. The blame for that lies solely on him, because the truth about Mary Gilbert's claims would soon come to light. Dr. Peter Hackett was not running a halfway home, nor a home for wayward girls. That much is certain. Whatever possibility there was of that was eliminated the moment Hackett denied ever speaking to Mary Gilbert. However, it is possible that Hackett did tell that to Mary Gilbert over the phone, because phone records show that Hackett did call Mary Gilbert from his wife's cell phone sometime in the early afternoon of May 3rd. How exactly he got Mary Gilbert's phone number is anyone's guess, because Shannon would not be reported missing until that very day, and her phone number hadn't been released by anyone. In fact, police hadn't come to ask questions yet, and wouldn't, for over a month. Both Dr. Peter Hackett and Alex Diaz, Shannon's boyfriend, recall meeting on May 4th, when Diaz made his second trip out to Oak Beach. But this would be a day after the phone call in question, and bring about the question of how Dr. Hackett knew what he did when he did. So, in some way and somehow, Peter Hackett learned of Shannon Gilbert's disappearance and also discovered the phone number of her mother. Also, what's more concerning, records show that the phone call wasn't made from Oak Beach. The cell phone Hackett was using was close enough to Mary Gilbert's home in New Jersey to warrant suspicion. That's right. Dr. Peter Hackett traveled to New Jersey to make that call to Mary Gilbert, and phone records show that he immediately lied about it. He would also call Shannon Gilbert's boyfriend, Alex Diaz, on May 6th, along with another call to Mary Gilbert. Hackett would recall making these phone calls, claiming that he was wishing them well in the search for Shannon. However, this again goes against his very own statements. He claims to have met the Gilberts and their associates on May 9th, 3 days after this second batch of phone calls was made. Even if he wasn't involved in the disappearance of Shannon Gilbert, something suspicious was going on with Dr. Peter Hackett. In the week after Shannon Gilbert's disappearance, Hackett shows off behavior that is alarming, or at the very least, deeply concerning. Due to the troubled start to the investigation, Suffolk County detectives didn't come out to Oak Beach to investigate Shannon Gilbert's disappearance for over a month. Then they finally got around to interviewing the neighborhood, including Gus Coletti, Barbara Brennan, and Shannon's client, Joseph Brewer. Unfortunately, they didn't really uncover anything. The detectives and police officers involved took some statements and did a little poking around, but to them, this was just a missing hooker, nothing more. Detectives spoke to Michael Pack, Shannon's driver, who told them that Shannon had been hesitant to pay him his cut and had likely run away. He claimed to have taken a polygraph test, something we all know is in no way a sure thing to prove innocence or guilt, but he passed it, which apparently cleared him of any guilt. Joseph Brewer claimed that he had Shannon over that night, but that the two of them had not had sex, despite her being in his house for nearly 3 hours. Dr. Peter Hackett denied having any involvement in Shannon's disappearance, and stuck to his statements about never knowing her or any of the Gilberts. All three were cleared as suspects in Shannon's disappearance well before she was ever located. And what's worse is the knowledge that police could have taken the time to try and find her quite easily, but chose not to. Whether this was due to miscommunication between the Jersey City Police Department, where her family filed the missing persons report, and Oak Beach, where she disappeared, or simply due to discrimination of her profession as a prostitute, is anyone's guess. This Oak Beach gated community had several security cameras pointed at spots throughout the neighborhood. Cameras which might not have offered any definitive proof, but at least helped point detectives in the direction of where Shannon had gone that fateful morning. These cameras were useless by the time that Suffolk County Police showed up, their memories overwritten a dozen times over. It was only by happenstance that any progress was made in the case. Sadly, progress means that one of the most horrifying discoveries in Long Island history was about to take place. John Malia was a 31-year veteran of the Suffolk County Police Department. A former private investigator turned officer, Malia was an expert at finding people, dead or living. Malia was also a canine officer, whose partner in law enforcement, Blue, had been with him for over 7 years at this point in 2010. A little over a month after Shannon Gilbert had gone missing, it was Malia that went out to the Oak Beach area where she had disappeared from. With his German Shepherd partner, Blue, in tow, 59-year-old Malia headed out to the small, coastal neighborhood and began searching for the missing woman. He admits that he wasn't actually looking for her and it was more of a training exercise, but he was still one of the very few to actually go out there and try. The two searched around the Oak Beach area for months, without finding so much as a trace of Shannon's tracks. The two scoped neighborhood and coastline, hoping to find at least something resembling Shannon Gilbert's belongings, but came away with nothing. Months continued to pass, with no headway in the case happening. Mary Gilbert kept checking in with the Jersey City Police to see if her daughter's missing persons file had been updated, but there was nothing. The three men surrounding her absence had been cleared by police of any wrongdoing, and Officer John Malia continued to make occasional trips to the area where Shannon Gilbert had last been seen. All of those trips were unsuccessful, at least until the morning of December 10th. December 10th, 2010. Shannon Gilbert had been missing for over 6 months now, just another missing prostitute in an area full of them. The only ones that gave notice to her prolonged absence were her family members, who had been given the cold shoulder by investigators for months due to Shannon's profession. Officer John Malia drove out to Oak Beach with Blue, in the hopes of at least giving the dog a little bit of tracking training. It was brisk and cold outside, just a hair above freezing, when Malia pulled over on the side of the highway. It was here, on the side of the four-lane Ocean Parkway, that Malia hoped to find some trace of Shannon. He had remembered reading something from the FBI that showed how most bodies, when left by a killer, were dumped within 30 feet of the road. Right around 3 in the afternoon, after walking through the prickly brush for a short amount of time, Blue began to wag his tail and make some adjustments with his head. Officer Malia immediately recognized this as a sign of him picking up something, a sign of something being found. Malia followed Blue into the marshy undergrowth, with the thick nettles surrounding them. The officer followed his canine companion deeper into the muck before stumbling upon an object of note roughly 50 feet away from the Ocean Parkway. It was a disintegrated burlap sack. Inside, Malia discovered, was the skeletonized remains of a human being. Sadly, it was not the body of Shannon Gilbert, but it was the first of nearly 11 bodies that would be uncovered over the next year, and the first sign that at least one serial killer had been using the area as a personal dumping ground for years.
Shannon always thought the odds were in her favor. She always was a positive person. She always was a kind and trusting person. She never liked to see the bad things in life, much less in people. And I think her ability to see love and forgiveness, what caused her to trust the wrong person. And right now, people out there who are watching, who are listening, who knows about Shannon and the other victims that were found, I just want to ask you, what if? What if it was someone that you loved? What if it was someone that you cared about? How would you feel if nobody came looking for you? How would you feel if you didn't feel love and forgiveness? I promise that I will continue to fight nonstop until I bring my girl home where she belongs. For now, I have no answers to tell myself to make me feel any better or for the truth, but I will not give up my fight.
Thank you.